Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for the New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. Today's guest is Catherine O'Rourke, and her book is O'Neill on Architecture, published by the University of Texas Press in 2019. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your educational background?
Okay, so I actually grew up in Houston, Texas, and I went to college at Wellesley, where I started to study architecture and got really interested in architectural history there, and in part because I was studying on this beautiful campus, beautiful landscape, and really interesting buildings. And from there, I went on to graduate school in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania, and got my master's and PhD in the history of art. And there I continued my study of architectural history, again, in a wonderful environment to be studying and with really great professors and mentors and friends.
Oh, wow. So this book, what was your motivation for writing it?
Right. So I, after I finished at Penn, I got a job teaching here in San Antonio, at Trinity University, which was it is a small liberal arts college. And I didn't really know that much about the university when I applied for the job. You know, the academic job market, you end up applying lots of different places. But as I was starting to learn about it, I came to understand a little bit about the architect of much of the campus, who was O'Neill Ford. But it wasn't until I came to be a professor here that I started to really appreciate Ford's work on the campus. The site is really an amazing site. It's cut in part out of there's a great rock face that divides it, and it has a really steep escarpment that divides the campus more or less east-west into two parts. And Ford designed the campus starting right around 1950, the university had predated that date, but was moving to this new campus, and he came and was hired and at the urging of an architect called William Worcester, who really encouraged the trustees to rather than bulldozing the site, making it really flat and level, and putting a kind of axial hierarchical plan down to let the hills design the buildings, as Worcester said. And Ford was a young architect who was very interested in history, but also in new technologies. And he and the other architects that he worked with there were among the very first to use a construction technology called the Utes slick lift slab construction method, where they poured concrete slabs on the ground and then hoisted them into place and affixed them to steel beams. And so I started learning about this history, and that was in the 1950s. I started learning about this history after I came to the campus to teach, and it was really in the course of walking on campus, walking to work every day, as I did when I first lived here, that I came to appreciate what an interesting and extraordinary place this was, in large part because of its landscape, but also because of its architecture and the relationship of the buildings to the site. So, I think architectural historians tend to get interested in wherever they are, right? They're, of course, we all have our own research that we're working on, but we're also, many of us, I think, looking around the world a lot. And so that was what I was doing. And I just wanted to know more about where I was. And so I started doing research in the university archives and also trying to find articles and speeches that Ford had written. So over the course of really the first 5 or so years that I was at Trinity, I was doing this. And then got to a point where I thought, you know, I've learned enough and I've gathered enough material that this would be worth pulling together in a book. And I should say that here in San Antonio and in Texas, Ford is considered a really important mentor and figure for a lot of architects, particularly here in Central and South Texas, who worked with him or were influenced by him. So he's a bit of a legend here. And I was, and there are two great books on him that other people wrote, of course, but I was interested in revisiting his ideas and also hopefully adding to the existing scholarship, but by bringing his voice a little bit more fully into our conversation in the 21st century about architecture and about San Antonio.
So what other, now I'm not familiar, or wasn't familiar mm-hmm. before the book about him. What other influences did he have on Texas architecture?
Mm-hmm. So Ford, he was really a multifaceted architect. And I mentioned the sort of technological innovation that got a lot of attention in the national press for the university almost as soon as it started being used. He was also extremely interested, though, in architectural history. And from an early age, he studied vernacular buildings here in Texas, but he also studied medieval architecture and Islamic architecture and colonial architecture in Latin America. And I think that that breadth, that broad interest, that richness, that certainly informed his own practice, and it helped that. In turn, he really helped cultivate here an appreciation of what is distinctive about this place, right? About Texas, and also I think gave architects ways of responding to the sort of dominant currents of international style modernism at mid-century and then after. So this, you know, manifests quite often in approaches to materials. Using local materials, for example, the primacy that he placed on site and making buildings yield to their landscapes, be sensitive to their to the ecological and the topographical and the conditions of climate in which they are built. Those are things that are still, I think, very much a part of many practices here. And of course, I have a lot of attention lots of other places, but it was a very important part of his work. The other thing that he did, and part of his interest in history, was that he was a real champion of conserving the colonial missions here in San Antonio. And we have five wonderful missions there now, UNESCO World Heritage sites, but it was in large part because of him and his wife and his wife's family that those missions are in the very good sort of states of conservation that they are today. So he was a champion of these sorts of things. And I think really for a lot of people sort of opened their eyes to what is significant in architecture here in Texas and sort of showed a way forward for innovative, responsive design, but design that was also very, very much in dialogue with the major currents of modernism in the United States in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Well, my master's degree is in landscape architecture, but when you start talking about, their first response to the university was to just level it. It even made me kind of go, ugh.
Right. Exactly.
So, and then you said that he really, you know, it's a little bit, well, they're both go hand in hand, but a little bit of landscape architecture too, citing the building. Sounds like that it was important to him. Was it important to him in his other projects as well? Can you think of something, another example of that?
Oh, yes. And I should say, in the 50s, especially Ford works very, very closely with two landscape architects called Arthur and Marie Berger. And they are really interesting people to know about. If you don't know about them, they were based in Dallas, and they were advocates already in the 50s of not necessarily xeriscaping, but the use of plant material that was native, right, to the place. At Trinity, they created a cactus garden. They used low water plants. The whole concept was to let what was native and what grew easily to be part of that landscape. And in some ways, there's some connection, maybe very broadly, to a picturesque tradition, but of course with the plants that are that grow well here in Texas. So he works with the Bergers also in a number of private houses that he designs, and a whole other part of his career is designing, you know, in some cases really large and elegant houses for private clients. And he works with them on some of those. And then later in his career, he works very closely with a landscape architect here in town called Stuart King at projects like La Villita. La Villita was it was one of the earliest settlements by Europeans here, dating, you know, all the way back to the very early days of San Antonio. But in 1939, Ford was actually, this what brought him to the city. He was hired to come and oversee a kind of conservation urban design project for La Villita, which ended up turning it into a kind of, today it's a sort of tourist center. But it the idea was to, in some way, evoke what small town life in 18th or 19th century Texas would have been like. And in that scheme, already from 1939, you look at the drawings and his notes on them, already he's calling for, again, these kinds of native plants and vegetation that is local. And that continues. And that's, I think, a really, really important part of his legacy here, because we, as in many parts of the country, of course, are very sensitive to water and to the availability of water for plants. And I think, you know, of course, trying to live in a way that is a little less damaging to the earth. So that's a huge part of that that tradition and legacy for him.
I did a whole project on the native plants here in mm-hmm. Key Largo and their importance and significance to the ecology and. Mm-hmm. For me, it was for the birds flying through.
Right.
But how that's interesting. You know, but that's nothing new that people have been saying. Yeah. You know, being sensitive to the environment's really important for all of us.
Right.
Him too. And he was trying to like bring it back. Well, that kind of brings me to a question here. In your book it's an intro on page 7. Mm-hmm. And you seem to be saying that, you know, the relationship to architecture, to the other arts, and a value to social sciences, you know, that to not let that relationship be broken. Did he, in his work, how did he bring together, because you said that you got your master's degree in art, though.
It's my all of my training really is in art history, right? I've always focused on architecture, but it's been from an art historical framework.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So how did he... bring art and bring the sciences together into his projects and his architectural mm-hmm. designs?
So one of the most important ways that this art is part of his work is through his collaborations with artists and craftspeople. And foremost among them was his own brother, Lynn Ford, who was really one of the great sculptors, I think. You can call him a sculptor. Many people would probably refer to him as a craftsman, but of 20th century Texas. And Lynn Ford And I should say their whole family was creative. I mean, they got this from their mother from a very early age. But Lynn Ford made these really beautiful works, particularly in wood, very abstract carvings that repeat often repetitive patterns over long, narrow slats of wood, for example, but each slat then having a different pattern. And also works in lead, in metal, and in many of Ford's great projects, the private houses, certainly already in the 50s, civic complex, the city hall, for example, in the little town of Denton, Texas, the civic center there, in the buildings at Trinity from the 1960s, which are actually pretty different from those works of the 50s that I was describing earlier. Lynn Ford's work is present in doors, in screens, in decorative panels. His brother O'Neill also worked closely with ceramicists Martha Mood and Beaumont Mood. He worked in various projects with Isaac Maxwell, who did wonderful work in mosaic. One of the things that is really distinctive about Ford's work, part of what makes it so special, is that I tend to think of him as a kind of symphony conductor, right? Ford buildings have a very distinctive quality. You know you're in an O'Neill Ford building, but he's not a starchitect. It's not the sort of heavy-handed thing. It's like he lets the other artists speak and manages to pull together these different distinct elements, each of them very recognizable as the work of these different masters, in this wonderful harmony, in buildings that are restrained, they are understated, but they are very elegant, they are very precise, and the precision of craftsmanship and work and the attention to materials, all of that is just really, really fine in these buildings. And that's also part of the legacy, right? This attention to craft and what materials do. It really does go hand in hand with his rational self, his interest in exploring, of course, the new technologies of lift slab. He is very, very interested in as well the concrete shell construction that is perhaps the best known in the work of the Mexican architect Felix Candela. Ford works with Candela famous project in Denton. Also, he's influenced, uses that technology at the big Texas Instruments semiconductor building in Dallas, which is a hugely innovative and interesting project that was entirely for, of course, Texas Instruments, right, which is building these semiconductors and is at the heart of cutting edge science and also, interestingly, the defense industry in the Cold War. But that curiosity, that interest in materials, that interest in different ways of solving problems, that has a kind of scientific bent to it. I could go on. There are other examples, but I think that's part of what makes Ford really an important modern architect, that we see in his work these themes that we think of as characterizing modern architecture more broadly, the interest in history, the interest in using new technologies in artistic ways, the concern with the other arts, and certainly this interest in science, and also, we should say, in society, because that's what he's also thinking about as well.
So he's a little bit of an urban designer too.
I mean, I think, we don't have like giant, huge, great, examples of his urbanism, but he is certainly thinking at a social scale. And he had very strong views on cities and on preservation here in San Antonio. He was one of the people who led the fight against the building of a freeway right through, as happened unfortunately in so many U.S. cities, right through historic neighborhoods, really highly destructive. And that was a fight that actually he and his wife ran for city council on an anti-freeway platform. That went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, to give you a sense of what a big deal that was. And he was also, he got in big trouble really for criticizing, a lot of the things that were happening in urban planning in the 60s and lost, you know, some important commissions because he spoke out in favor of parks and in favor of human scale and pedestrians and history and preservation, things that stood or were imagined, right, to stand in the way of so-called progress as it was understood sort of in the mainstream at that point.
Oh, well, to that point, I could appreciate that a little bit because driving through Miami traffic this evening was a bit challenging. And how pedestrian walking ways and parks are finally now kind of going, people going, that is a smart thing to do after all.
Yes. Well, and I just learned or was hearing about this, that the United Nations, a huge group of nations, got together and affirmed that preservation and the conservation of historic buildings is an essential ingredient to urban vitality, and to have that kind of consensus on something, you know, really only 50 years after the consensus was entirely in the opposite direction. We're at a really interesting moment in that. And I think that's part of why Ford feels really relevant today, because he's speaking about ecological, I mean, he didn't use the word ecology so much, but things that we think of as ecological or climate crisis kinds of topics. Clearly he was on the right side of issues with respect to these freeways and human scale and the sort of structure of cities. I should say, though, at the same time, he certainly had plenty of suburban clients and, you know, in his own practice did advance the suburbanization in various ways.
Well, it's just kind of give and take. He's kind of got to do a little bit of everything, too.
Yeah, right. The pragmatic part.
So it was interesting kind of talk about that because in art class that I've been in, and we're talking about, you know, it's art is left and right brain. You got to be able to do it all.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And he, you know, I think he has sort of multiple faces in the history. And I should say the book that I did is really a edited volume of his writings and speeches from 1932 until the very end of his life in the early 80s. And I, as you know, wrote this introduction and have a little introductory gloss to each of the texts that were his. But one of the things that, you know, you sort of see when you look across the career is that he's hard to pin down, right? He doesn't fit a lot of the conventional sort of brackets or molds. And I mean, to me, that's part of what makes him such an interesting architect and, again, someone who I think is really worth knowing about and studying for people who are interested in the history of 20th century modernism in the United States.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it sounds like, you know, his buildings are important because you don't know that's his style. In a sense, that's kind of that's a true accomplishment.
Yes, exactly. And as I said, there is a very distinctive, you know you're in an O'Neill Ford building, but he's not a sort of style heavy architect.
So you talk about here a little bit about his on chapter, well, I'm not sure what chapter, organic building. So tell me more about this chapter. Why did you write it?
Okay, so organic building is one of his early essays from 1932. And it is a really, really fascinating piece. It's one of the first things that he publishes as a young architect when he is beginning to set out on his own after working in the office of David R. Williams. And it's a piece that I found one of the most intriguing of all the ones that I read of all of his speeches and writings. He talks about the need to embrace certain principles of what he calls functionalist architecture, which was the term that was widely used for what we sometimes call international style architecture in the 1930s. And so that is in there. And he's clearly at various points evoking Le Corbusier and the famous Towards a New Architecture manifesto that Corbusier wrote in the early 20s. But what was maybe most striking to me in that particular work was the way that he spoke out again about conservation of the land and about the landscape. And he is extremely critical of what he locates as a sort of pioneer mentality. And by that, he means Anglo settlers moving across North America and what he really regards as a destruction of the landscape, a willful disregard of natural beauty and a kind of abuse of the land. And to read that, you know, from someone in Texas, frankly, in 1932 was quite astounding, right? Because even today, that's a sort of controversial approach to take. And he certainly risked with that alienating, isolating prospective clients and colleagues as well. But he never had any problem speaking out and talking about what he believed strongly in. And over and over and over in the writings, you hear this theme repeated, this real anger about the loss of landscape.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Oh, that's so interesting. And carrying it forward to today, we're still having to speak out about, and now it's become a more of a crisis with, you know, sea level rise, et cetera, and everything. Mm-hmm. And
Now
he's in vogue.
Exactly. But to imagine this being written so long ago, really, and also, frankly, in a culture where that was, you know, kind of impossible to imagine people talking about in that way.
Well, that definitely took real courage.
he seemed to be fearless.
So tell me, what's another one of your favorite projects by him that you included in this book?
So one of the other really wonderful texts is from the mid-1960s. This is a speech that he gives at Rice University in Houston. It was part of a series of lectures called The People's Architects. And in it, he repeats some of these themes about landscape, but he also talks very emphatically about civil rights and comes out very strongly in favor of civil rights and is critical of segregation and of an attitude, any kind of attitude that would restrain individual freedoms and liberties, and very clearly equates the way that we treat the landscape and treat the built environment with how we treat each other. And it's still stirring. You know, I'm sorry to say it feels newly relevant now that we need to say these things all over again. But again, it was astounding to think of him standing up in segregated Houston and saying this, of course, to an all-white audience in an extremely privileged environment. And just coming out and doing that. And again, that's risk-taking there. He had in his clients, in his friends, people who were also very much progressive in their political thinking. One of the most important was Eric Johnson, who was mayor of Dallas and helped lead the desegregation process there, which was extremely difficult and painful. And who also was the one of the leaders of Texas Instruments.
And to read Johnson's remarks about civil rights is also, you know, fascinating. And you begin to see that Ford existed in a kind of constellation of people who were really trying to advance civil rights and a very progressive social agenda. The other really important figures in all of this actually were the Johnsons, were President and Mrs. Johnson, and Lady Bird Johnson in particular, knew Ford and admired his work. And of course, probably Johnson's greatest legacy, of course, is the shepherding of the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s.
Well, it's interesting. I thought it was interesting what you said about how we treat the land is also relative to how we treat each other.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Ford was doing, this was totally clear in his mind. And that there was a kind of analogous relationship between what we did to nature and how we structured society and kept people in or out, as it were.
Either like build bridges and connectivity or put up walls.
Right, exactly. And you know, what is, I think, you know, Ford would have said this too, what is the most, you know, is profit going to be the most important thing, or is doing the right thing the most important thing? And that's what, you know, I think drives a lot of what he's thinking about in different ways. And he had extremely affluent clients and connections, certainly, but had no hesitation in going against the grain.
Well, he seemed to have made it anyway. And I was thinking about that. You know, he was opposed to the highway, but you know, a highway is just a flat wall.
Yes, that's right. But a highly destructive one.
But a very destructive one. Yeah, it's probably scarier.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it's so interesting as cities now are, you know, in some cases taking down their freeways or trying to find ways to cap them or to mitigate the damage, right? And we're, as we've said, trying to make cities more friendly to pedestrians and bikers and people.
Yeah, have a people-friendly city. Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of reminds me a little bit in the Keys. You know, a lot of people pass through down here and go straight to Key West. And really, I think one of the reasons why it's because it's so popular is because, and I enjoy going down there too, is because it's walkable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. And I think that that's, you know, there are... The environments that people are routinely drawn to are those where it's easy to be, right? Where you don't have to get in a car, where there's a sense that, you know, buildings exist in a way that is supportive of the kind of basic activities of our lives. Yeah.
Sure. Well, you know, I want to skip to another chapter here. Mm-hmm. I just thought this was really cute. Imagineering.
Yes, right. Imagineering. So that's a really interesting article in which he's talking to young architects and engineers, and this kind of goes back to the kind of technology side of it. But it's a great piece because he, you know, on the one hand is this sort of, I mean, truly internationally for a moment, you know, internationally celebrated architect because of Lift Slab, and he's invited to, you know, speak in London and gets these, you know, various engagements. He teaches at, you know, lots of fancy institutions of the East Coast. But what he comes back to in all of it is saying, yeah, but all of the slide rules, of course, I think about slide rules, all the calculations, those are all fine, but you have to have some art to it, right? And there has to be basic sort of common sense and understanding about the physical world, right? The way that buildings stand up, about the way materials function and the nature of the materials. And that, you know, in the absence of that, the engineering isn't going to get you to the art. Now, he admires engineers tremendously. There are several that he names at various points that whose work he just loves. But it's really those who you know, touch that aesthetic moment, right? Who reach that sort of aesthetic height in their designs. So again, I think he's such a fascinating case study in the ways in which the sciences and the arts and humanistic concerns and social and political concerns were coming together. And he wasn't, you know, the only person by any means who was somehow doing all this, but he's one that, again, I think through the writings, through the speeches, we can understand this very interesting moment in the middle of the 20th century in the United States when so much is in flux and so much is at stake, right? It's the Cold War. It's a period of obviously tremendous social change, changes, as we've been talking about, to cities and to the landscape, but also a moment where perhaps one sort of way of doing things is going out, and another is coming in, and all of it under the, you know, sort of cloud of the Cold War and the anxieties about atomic weapons.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Kind of destruction against the environment, trying to conserve the environment.
Right.
And also architecture.
That's right. And also, of course, the very, you know, real fear that many people lived with of nuclear proliferation.
Oh, and that whole backdrop and how it influenced him. Mm-hmm. I have interest. How do you see a professional, what kind of professional architect or even landscape architect, what can they gain from reading this book? Mm-hmm. What perspective do you think they could get?
You know, I think it's always helpful to, hear how other people have tried to solve problems at other times, because so much of architecture is about problem solving. I that's one of the things I admire so much about architects is that they have to work with whatever the conditions are, right? Whether it's the site or the budget or the materials or the client or whatever it is, and they have to come up with a solution. And I think there's value in seeing how another person who was obviously quite successful and influential was also wrestling with problems and was also, frustrated. Because one of the things that comes through in some of the writings is his real frustration with the state of the world, which everybody can identify with, of course, some level. And yet the great hope that he maintains, the great hope that he has in art and indeed in people, to make the world better, right? That sense of architects having a larger calling. And, you know, I mean, there are certainly plenty of architects who don't feel that, you know, maybe that's not why they were drawn to architecture, but I think there are a lot who do, right? There is, it's a tremendously optimistic profession in certain respects. The belief that through design, through landscape, through building, through thinking about cities, designing them well, that we can make a better world. And I think that's part of what comes through really clearly in Ford and is worth revisiting, right? Even though the challenges in some ways may be very different today, they're not always so different.
Just different characters.
Yes, that's right. And certainly the profession has changed enormously since he was working and there are new pressures and new stresses, but I think that fundamental optimism is there, and it's a good reminder too that you know, some of the problems that we're wrestling with today are not new. I think in some ways that can be kind of a comfort.
Yeah, that's true, and I think when you're talking about him, it's like, you know, the inspiration, the courage to just stand up and you know I go back to a little bit of Harry Potter book. I always love this quote, you know, it's the choice between to do what's easy and what's right.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And he lost clients. He lost commissions following that guide.
and that's true. There's always consequences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go to, how about this chapter? It's kind of interesting. This is a nice little end quote here. What's the end of the beginning? Or the end of a beginning.
The end of a beginning. So that is a talk from 1967, and that was actually the commencement address at Trinity University. Ford was invited to give this lecture. He had and his colleagues had been working on the campus, building it almost continuously from the early 50s into the late 60s there. And that's why he calls it the end of the beginning. He sees it as the kind of end of this new campus, right? And this new an institution who's sort of the early phase of its new incarnation is wrapping up. And it's a great talk if you are really interested in the campus and want to learn how he thought about the design and its history. What is also wonderful about it is that he talks implicitly about the importance of having a great client. And I often find myself repeating, you know, the idea that great architecture requires a great client. And that to be a great client is hard work. Quite often, certainly in the case of Trinity in the 50s and 60s, it meant taking risks because they created a campus that looked very different from certainly almost every college campus in Texas and many in other parts of the country, and a willingness to forge ahead, to do bold things. And he really, really makes the case that there was a kind of co-evolution between the university and the campus. And he ends up calling Trinity the University of Positive Progressive Protest, which is a very, it's a great compliment coming from him. And that he frames it in terms, again, of a kind of productive resistance against the norm. And I think that's, it's inspiring to think about, and also, you know, kind of a, if there are any prospective architectural patrons out there who might pick up this book, something to think about as well. What is your role if you are so fortunate to be in a position to be able to hire an architect? I love that speech also because he opens it by talking about Thomas Jefferson, actually, because he starts writing it when he is coming to the end of a term teaching at the University of Virginia, which, of course, Jefferson designed. And he has just enormous, enormous admiration for Jefferson as an architect, but also, again, as a kind of polymath, right? Ford talks about his botany and his writings and his command of language. And the fact that Ford seems to, you know, see this connection between the early founding of the Republic, the highest ideals embodied in Jefferson's work, and this, you know, pretty small, relatively unknown university in San Antonio, Texas, that sense that somehow that great work of the Enlightenment is being carried on, right? And that there is a connection between the Declaration of Independence and the spirit of positive progressive protest that he believes existed at Trinity.
Oh, that's just, oh, so Thomas Jefferson, the famous memorial up there, the rotunda, the circle.
Mm-hmm, the rotunda, exactly, right. And the academical village, right, that Jefferson talks about, the library, and then the buildings that form frame that sort of mall there on the oldest part of the UVA campus with the different departments, right? It's really a kind of landscape of the liberal arts.
What other interesting factoids did you find out that surprised you about him?
You know, this was really interesting. We were talking a moment ago about nuclear weapons. So at the 1960 AIA, the American Institute of Architects annual convention, Ford was one of the people who was chosen as a respondent to Robert Oppenheimer, who was, of course, one of the people who helped develop the atomic bomb, but then also thereafter went and really devoted the rest of his life to working for peace and non-combat uses of nuclear technologies. That really, for me, put into perspective how significant Ford was in his own time and what his colleagues thought of him to ask him to respond to this person who was world famous and who had done so much, of course, to shape the 20th century. That was amazing to see. And Ford, I think he was very sensitive to the, you know, issues that he was being asked to address there. And interesting also, I should note that the American Institute of Architects wanted to hear from a major scientist at their convention. Again, I think it gives you a sense of the sort of ways in which the sciences and the arts and design were all, you know, intermingling in that period. But Ford, you know, it comes out again very clearly and unsurprisingly in favor of using the money, the resources, the knowledge that went into the making, of course, of those weapons for other purposes, and redirecting the energies of the United States away from the Cold War.
Oh, instead of destruction and will against nature.
Exactly.
Trying to build something positive like a university campus.
For example, right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fascinating. Catherine, thank you so much for being here today. I know we've taken up a lot of your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
This is really awesome. I did not know him before I read your book. Can you tell us about interesting projects that you're working on now, or any other interesting facts about him that our audience should know?
Let's see. I guess to take that first question, the project that I'm starting to work on actually has come in part out of my study of Ford. I'm very interested in the dynamics of humanism at mid-century in modern architecture, and how a lot of actually the themes and the topics that we have been talking about here were also operating or of interest to other architects in that time. I should say the first book that I wrote is very different from O'Neill Ford on Architecture, and was a book about 20th century architecture in Mexico City. And much of my research has been on Mexican modernism. But sort of between the two of those, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is the way that architects deal with history and deal with the past in the 20th century. The ways that their understandings of the past or their imaginations of, in some cases, very, very distant pasts intersect with their concerns about modern society and modern life. And so those are some of the things I'm thinking about in buildings by Frank Lloyd Wright, by Eric Mendelsohn, like Le Corbusier, and as well as by Eladio Dieste, who was I'm thinking about a lot right now because I just got back from Uruguay several weeks ago. He was an engineer who created beautiful, beautiful works in brick using very thin shell construction and curvature and really sophisticated calculations, but to create extraordinarily beautiful spaces. He was someone I think that O'Neill Ford would have admired and liked very much. So that's sort of how my work is evolving at the moment.
So to leave it, is there any other little factoid about O'Neill that students would like to know?
Let's see. You know, one thing that we haven't mentioned that I think is neat to know about is that he was very interested in students and in education. And that was just a pervasive concern all the way through his life. Near the very end of it, he did a little television program here in San Antonio with school-aged children called Lessons in Looking. And part of that sort of transcript is actually reproduced in the book. But it's wonderful to read this because he's talking in really simple language to these kids about how to see, right? Lessons in looking, that this is how you start to see the world and also to understand it in material ways. And he talks to them about things like mud and bricks and stone and things that we don't even, you know, necessarily notice, right, or maybe take for granted. And there are just these delightful exchanges between him and the children that I think are valuable for many of us to revisit as we think about how we see and perceive the world and the very sort of fundamental stuff of architecture and of making.
Making stuff, Lincoln logs.
Yes, right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And train sets.
Right.
Catherine, Thank you so much for being here today, and we look forward to hearing more from you.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for being here today. Again, this is Tricia from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for the New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And today's book was O'Neill Ford on Architecture by Catherine O'Rourke, published by the University of Texas Press in 2019. Thank you so much.